Thank you very much. Thank you very much to the organizers of the workshop for this kind invitation, and thank you also to the Fields Institute for their generous support. And well, so I will speak about this problem, which probably many of you know, and probably some of you know much more than I about it, so maybe you're a bit bored that this is the beginning. I must give some credits first. I will show you some pictures, and I have two kind of pictures, cool ones and cheesy ones. The cheesy ones are mine, and the cool ones I took them sometimes from the internet, sometimes from these guys that have worked quite a lot on the topic. So mainly there is a very nice historical review paper by Saf and Krieglars on the topic, and also the PhD thesis of Sue has a lot of pictures, and also I took some pictures from some other writings of Dragnes, and well, of other authors too, which I will try to mention. So well, the problem seems very easy to state, just give some good way to distribute points in the sphere. In the two-dimensional sphere, all the talk is about two-dimensional sphere inserted in R3. So you can see that the context is extremely naive. So S is the x in R3, such that the norm of x is equal to 1, just that, that's the sphere. And so well, on the one hand, there doesn't seem, yeah? Oh, it is harder. Yeah, probably nothing is known, or almost nothing is known. Only very few things with high dimensions, some of the things that are known in high dimensions. So, well, intuitively, everybody would say, this is kind of well distributed in the sphere. This is kind of well distributed in the sphere. This is not well distributed in the sphere. That's intuition, and everybody would agree on that. Now, these three pictures come from very different things. This is a construction which is just made following some rules, which I may explain later. So they give you some routes, and you start to put points in the sphere following these instructions, and you get this, pretty well distributed. This is the output of a certain minimization algorithm, which tries to minimize a certain quantity, which intuitively has something to do with putting points in the sphere. I will also specify later. And this is just picking points at random in the sphere. So well, that is intuition. Now, this in nature we have examples of not well distributed. Maybe that is why people have started to study this problem. So my next picture is here, for I hope that Carles would like it. He spoke yesterday about the solar system as star systems and so on, as things that move. So today I will look at the whole universe as a completely static thing. And the only thing that I will allow to move is the point of view of the observator. So we choose just the point in the space after choosing some kind of coordinate system in our universe. And then you choose a point, for example, the point where the Earth is. And then you choose time, for example, maybe 20 days ago when this was done, or 2 years ago. And then you choose a direction where you look. And then, well, it's kind of a chance that the brightest stars of the universe that we can see from here, they are distributed in the sphere, somehow. If we are in the center of the Earth and the Earth is transparent, of course, then we would see something like that. So that is something that appears in nature, and it's not well distributed. Now, of course, the interest of well-distributed things is has been much more studied, because something that one could hope to try to understand, and that might have some applications. So these pictures are related, at least the first one, to the beginning of the story of this problem. So this problem was first studied, well, not exactly because of that, but because of the electrons in the sphere, which I will speak later. But one of the first things that people came interested in is this picture here. So there was a a botanist called what was that? Oh, God, I forgot. I'm sorry. Thames. So a botanist called Thames in the 1930s, more or less, he started to be interested in the shape of the pollen particles. So So well, he obtained kind of images like that, probably not so precise, which seem to say that their nature has a way to decide how to distribute points in a sensible fashion somehow. So if you put a point in the center of each of these hexagons or whatever they are, then you get a good way to put points in the sphere, somehow good, with respect to some criterion. And then Thames thought that this criterion might be the following. Maximize the minimum of the distance from one point to another. So that is a criterion. You put points in the sphere such a way that this quantity is as big as possible. Now that is a Thames criterion. Then one can wonder if that is actually what is happening in other life structures. So here we have another one, the flu virus. Let me say some few words on how these pictures are obtained nowadays. This is I don't know if it is the swine flu, but probably so famous. Yeah. Are you in the group of risk? Then yeah. So let me say how these pictures are obtained nowadays. I just saw a beautiful talk by Chandra Bahak from the Texas University in Austin. And he is working with a big team on obtaining these kind of very, very precise pictures of virus. And how they do that? They take a very sick person, so you leave someone in Toronto in winter, naked all the night, and then following day you have a big amount of flu virus to experiment with. Then you take some blood out of him, and then you make some chemical process or whatever to separate the virus from the rest, which is not interesting for you. And then, well, they put it in a planar surface, and somehow they use some cryogenic technique to have it completely frozen. And once it is completely frozen, because of some chemical properties, which I don't understand, it happens that viruses are in such a way that they are not one over the other, but all of them are, you can see them. You know, you don't have like two layers of virus, you just have one big layer. And then they just make one picture of that, only with one picture, according to somehow of a reasonably imaginable statistic properties. Not all the viruses will be in the same position, but each of them will be in a certain position. And statistically, one can expect that there is not a position which is better than the others. So, well, you can expect that all of them will be more or less, well, all the variations are represented there. And then with just one picture of that, with a very precise picture, of course, with a microscopic electron, they are able to reconstruct the whole geometric properties of the object. And they are able to do that up to 10 nanometers or something like that. And then they want this because they obtained this very fancy drawing of the virus, much more detailed than this one. And then they get the same with the protein. And then they can decide if the protein will go into the virus and stop the chemical thing. Well, then it's even better for you, because the only problem that you could have is that there is a direction which is more present than the others. But the virus is in this case, then you don't have to worry. Each of them, in this case, the picture of just one virus would give you the whole information. So the fact that you need a lot of virus is because there are viruses which are very strange, and they can have, you. All of you have probably seen this one, which I don't know which is, maybe the AIDS virus or something like that. So, but if they are round, they just one picture will give you the whole information, right? You don't need more pictures. All pictures will be equal, indeed. So no extra info. So that is the simple case. So this is the simple case, indeed. And again, one could not very naturally ask the question, will it happen that the way that these dots are distributed in the sphere is also the way that these ones are distributed? Will it be again this Thames suggested quantity, the one that is playing a role there? Does biology have a natural way of creating that? So, well, of course, the first thing that one should do to do that is try to obtain somehow mathematically a minimization set of points satisfying that. Check it with here, check it with here. If they are similar, well, make some experimentations. So well, it happens that this is a difficult problem. Yeah?
Does the distribution depend on the specific number of points? I mean, if you add one to that, can you still have the same distribution by changing them all around?
You would say, well, of course, this quantity can be minimized for any number. No? So you can consider this with 100 points or with 101, and the things will change. Everything will change. So I don't know if this answers the question. Yeah. So well, probably from 100 to 101, you won't see it, you know, just in a picture. But there is a change, and it is not a clear change. There is not a simple way to say that you have a minimizing tuple for n equals 100, and now you want to add another one. Then you would say, okay, just make this a little change, make one of the holes a bit bigger, and put one there. This doesn't work. This is not the minimum. So there can be many, many changes on microscopic scale. And so well, I put just a third example of another thing in nature, more big, that it also has this little circles full of some liquid which gives a flame. I don't know why it has it, but anyway, one could also consider why. Why are they this way? Is it, again, with respect to the same function? So well, let me first try to put some mathematics. So well, I will use the following notation. So when I write W is just a set x1, xn of points in the sphere. So this is contained in the sphere 2 power of n. And big N will always be the number of points and will always be fixed during this talk. And then, so well, this quantity, I will call it d of W. Okay? So well, one of the things that one could try to say is this, no? Find W that maximizes this. So that is an extremal property that could be satisfied. Yeah? Yeah, sorry. D of W is the mean, and then you are interested in satisfying, maximizing D of W. Yeah, thank you. So, well, that is one thing that you could expect. But there are other reasonable definitions that you could give. So, here is one. Maximize the volume of the convex envelope. I think that this is another very reasonable definition. And it is another problem which doesn't seem to be very well understood. Here is another one. Minimize some energy. So the energy could be something like that. The sum with I smaller than j of xi minus xj to the power of minus f. Let me call this e to f, of course, of w. And this will be bigger than 0. So, well, if you have two very close by points, this thing will explode to infinity. You're not interested in that. So that is a reasonable way to define it. And there is kind of a extreme case of this, which I will just denote by a 0 of w, which is the one that I am most interested in now, which is this one. So it's kind of a limit property of that. No? So well, this is called the energy. If F equals 1, this is the Coulomb potential. So, well, if S equals 1, then you have the sum of the inverses of these distances, which happens to be the potential of n electrons situated in the surface of the sphere. This was indeed the first case that was studied and the first case that was interesting, and it's started to be studied by Thompson. So it's sometimes called Thompson's problem to be able to minimize that. Thompson's problem, which is not understood. It is not known the value of the minimum. It is, even up to certain precision, it is not known. This is also not known. Not known the value of the minimum of that thing for n different from, I think, 1, 2, 4, 6, 8, or 20. Every other values are not known. So, well, of course, everybody would imagine that certainly for low values, the answer to all these problems must be the regular platonic solids. And yes, they are. So for these very few values, so well, you have the answer. And I think to remember that these are the answers to this one, and to this one for S equals 1, and also to this Stan's problem. So well, they are so regular and they have so many good properties, but well, this is like the easy part. But of course, you know, there doesn't exist anymore, so then one can start to try to do other things. And all of you also know that picture, mainly the guys from South America will recognize this pretty easily, I think. And so well, here you have, that's 1, 2, 3, there are 12 pentagons, and the rest, no, it is 12 pentagons? Oh, what is that? Oh no, this is, there are no pentagons here. Oh no, there are no pentagons, so this can't be possible. So maybe I don't know where I got that, but this is not what I meant. So I just wanted to have this developed, but maybe I got cheated in the internet, you know, you see this picture and you say this one. No. So well, here you have these 12 pentagons and 20 hexagons, and this is the football ball. And here, there happens to be a molecule only made of carbon atoms, which has exactly that configuration. And this molecule was discovered by those guys called Buckminster Fuller N, which must be important somehow because those guys received the Nobel Prize of Chemistry. Not only for the discovery of that, but for the investigations and this kind of stuff. So, well, that is something. I mean, suddenly, the N equals 60 appears again in nature in a very, very clear way. So this molecule exists. Now, probably what I will tell you now is a completely trivial fact for most of you, but I was really surprised when I saw it, and I didn't remember it from the undergrad. Maybe I studied it in the undergrad, which is the following thing. So please, if this is too basic, just tell me and I will skip it. So say that you cover the sphere with 8 hexagons and P pentagons. Assuming that the angles are not very weird, so smaller than 120, bigger than 90. And, well, so one can wonder how many hexagons and pentagons can you have? And it happens that you always must have 12 pentagons. And this is a very easy thing to say, to do. And so let me try, I will try not to fail now. So you have the other characteristic of the sphere, which you can compute easily because the sphere can be modeled by the cube, and then you compute it to be 2, and then it has to be equal to the number of faces minus the number of edges plus the number of vertices. Now if you have 8 hexagons and P pentagons, then the number of faces will be something like H plus P. The number of edges, it will be, so 6 for each hexagon, 5 for each pentagon, and the H is going to be counted twice, so you have to divide by 2. And then the number of vertices, so these conditions here are put in such a way that you have exactly 3 vertices. In 3 edges in every vertex. So the number of vertices, is again 6H plus 5P, and this time is divided by 2. By 3, sorry. Yeah. Oh, so you're paying attention, really, not only saying. And this has to be equal to 2. So now, well, we multiply by 6. To erase things, and then we have 6H plus 6P minus 3 times this, that must be 18H minus 15P, and then plus 12H plus 15P, is that plus 10P, yeah, thank you, is equal to 12. And that is it, isn't it? So this is correct. 6 minus 16 plus 12 is simplified, and then you have 6 plus 10 is 16, minus 15, that is 1. So P is equal to 12. So every such a configuration that you describe must have exactly 12 pentagons, which does not mean that you can choose 12 pentagons and 125 hexagons. Maybe not. But it must have exactly 12 pentagons, which is quite a funny property. So, the football ball is well thought. Now, let me give you some other reasons why this thing should be useful. It's not only because of understanding the shape of stuff, but it also has some other applications. I already mentioned the electrostatics somehow, no? Because this understanding how the electrons will distribute in the sphere, maybe it is not an exactly real-life problem because electrons are not in spheres, but it's kind of similar to one what would try to understand at the first glance to understand how they distribute, say, in the surface of a atom. So, biral morphology, crystallography, molecular structures, not only this one, also there are some crystals and so on that have these special structures. And some mathematical application would also be the quadrature formulas. So, all of you know that if you want to take the best quadrature formula in that interval minus 1, 1, then you have to take these points. What was the name? Chebyshev points or something like that. I don't remember exactly the name. Which are not minus 1 half or 1 half or whatever, but something like minus 0.7 something something and 0.7 something something. And then this gives you the best way to integrate functions which are up to, I think, polynomials up to degree 4 or 3 are exactly integrated using that, which is quite an amazing fact. And these points are somehow strange in the interval, because why exactly those ones? But in the case of the sphere, it can't be that strange, for we are in a completely symmetric object. So the very reasonable way to do that would be to say, let the points satisfy some kind of maximation property, some kind of extremal property like that. That would be a very reasonable option. So let me give you a glance on what it exists with respect to that. Well, first, just to be a bit correct, what you would expect is that this is equal or very approximately equal to 1 over n times the sum of f of x I for a wide class of functions. So that is what you would want, really. For example, one could ask, given degree b of polynomials in three variables x, y, z, you want x1 and xn for some m such that there is an equality. That's something that you would very reasonably expect. That's a very reasonable question, I think. So, the question to that, the answer to that question is not clear at all. And Hardin and Sloan are able to do that up to degree 13 with a number equal 94. So, you can obviously, from these numbers, it's obvious that the problem is not easy. It's difficult, as I said in the title. So, that is another possible mathematical application. So, I hope that at least this gives you some glance of why this is interesting. There are also some relations with linear programming in both sides. So let me say linear programming, minimization in the sphere, minimization of points in the sphere. So the topic of the talk. Just read that, say the topic of the talk. So this direction was, some part of it was explained by Jinju Ye during the other workshop, the workshop on the complexity of numerical computation. So he used some linear programming problems to try to approach to the following one, which is very related also to the one that I am explaining here. So the problem that he had is, he had the sphere, and then he wanted to put as many spheres as possible, just kissing it of radius smaller than some given quantity epsilon. So this is obviously another way to define how points are distributed. If you are able to get a perfect configuration here, where everything is kissing and everything has radius exactly epsilon, If you like that, then the projections of the points in the sphere, the projections of the centers of these spheres, would certainly provide a very reasonable way to distribute points in the sphere again. So, well, Professor Ye explained how this can help here, and I recently learned from my talk that maybe also an application in the other sense. So for integral labeling, please correct me if I'm wrong, for an integral labeling strategies to try to solve f of x equals 0, one must, say, make some discretization of a certain space, and the discretization must be done in such a way that, well, you choose points in the sphere, and every point that of the sphere must be very close to one of the ones that you choose. And there is an additional property related to that. These points must be numbered in a certain way that allows you to get a lot of information just from the numbering. And, well, this is not so easy property. It's much more delicate, probably, than what we are speaking about. So, but there is there must be some relation. And, well, I say so. So Top described some points which can attain, well, a reasonable bound, which is, well, so a certain reasonable bound. So, well, let me say this also appears in the art, and I have this picture prepared for when I say the thing of the pentagons and the hexagons. So this is in a Chinese palace, and you can see there the meaning of the lion. There is another female lion also, which has another meaning when putting the paw on another thing, which I don't remember. And it has this ball. And this is, well, it is not so easy, but if you spend time enough, you will be able to recognize at least a couple of the 12 pentagons that appear there. There are 12 pentagons in this ball. Okay, so more things that have been done are these ones. So Rachmaninoff, Pfaff, and so, they studied this problem, and they got this beautiful thing. So they are trying to find pieces of the sphere with the following properties. So divide the sphere in, say, big N pieces such that the area of each is exactly equal to 4 pi over N, and such that the diameter of each is small. How small? As small as possible. And then they proved that this can be done, obtaining a diameter of, well, I'm sorry, I can't find it, I wrote too many formulas here. So the diameter that you obtain is something like 1 over square root of n, which is believed to be optimal. Actually constant. Maybe it could be 0.2 over square root of n, but essentially that. So, well, this is another way to approach the problem, that is not exactly choosing points, but choosing areas, and then, for example, one can choose at the point the center of gravity of each of the areas. And that would also give you a very reasonable way to approach to it. And, well, so you have here these examples. Here, what we are representing are the Dirichlet cells, which I am not sure if will play a role later, so I will write the definition. The Dirichlet cells of W are the set, so you consider DI equal the Y in the sphere such that Y minus XI is equal to the distance of Y to W. So essentially what this is a set of points which are, whose closest point in the ones that you chose is exactly the one that you're looking at. So this is defined for I equals 1 to N. And then, well, here we chose some points in the sphere, which are obviously pretty well distributed, and then we draw the associated Dirichlet cells. Here is the pentagonal one, and there are more, of course. And it happens that in every single heuristically obtained way to distribute the points correctly in the sphere, all the Dirichlet cells are hexagonal or pentagonal. And the number of pentagonal ones is 12, of course. So that's something. And, of course, one doesn't get the hexagons and the pentagons completely regular, but pretty regular, and certainly satisfying this property which is, I insist, I think, a very, very reasonable one. And well, one can also see that from such a configuration, one can obtain another reasonable configuration, which would be you take the points that you chose, and then you put a point in each of the vertices of the Dirichlet cells, and you obtain another configuration. So, well, yes, that's another thing that you can play with and that you can try to, well, that you can check that there is nothing that you can prove. So, well. Now, let me go and center a bit in the logarithmic energy, which is the one that I am most interested about. So, well, this is called the logarithmic energy. And the minimizing points are called elliptic Fekete points. The points that minimize the Coulomb potential are called just Fekete points, and the ones that minimize the logarithmic potentials are called elliptic Fekete points. Now, why these points are especially interesting? So, well, let me just first remind here Smale's seventh problem, which is the following. Find W, so W, remember that is x1 xn, such that the energy of W minus, well, the energy is zero, so the energy of W minus the minimal possible value is smaller than or equal to a constant times the logarithm of big N. So, well, we have quite a big margin to move on. We have this log N margin. And first difficulties come when you notice that the value of this minimal energy is not even known up to the precision of logarithm of n. So this makes it a really difficult question. What is known about the value of the minimum of zero is the following. And this is due to Kass and Krieglar, same ones that I erased, that I stole some of the pictures from their paper. So what is known is, where are you? C1 is smaller than or equal to this minimum. Sorry, no. Ah, yeah. So let the minimum of E0 is equal to 1 over 4 times the logarithm of 4 over E n squared minus 1 over 4 big N, the logarithm of big N, minus a certain quantity. And this certain quantity satisfies that its limits, and its lim sup, are bounded by constants, and the constants are, well, let me just write Rn times n, so this will be up to the position of n. The constants lie between minus 0.1127 something something and minus 0.023 something something. So that is the more detailed result that is known about how to minimize the energy. And you can see that you do not even know the asymptotic value of the constant that is multiplying big N. And the Smale's problem is asking for being able to find log N approximation. So this shows that still we are pretty far from understanding the problem globally. Well, time is going, so let me just explain very briefly why Smale what Smale says that was one of the reasons to include this problem in his list. Of course, Well, there are many reasons, because it's a very famous and important problem, but a particular reason that he describes is the following, and it has to do with an area which is apparently completely unrelated, but it happens not to be, which is the following. Now we take just an F, a polynomial on X, on big X. So if you have f of X of degree n, and we let C1 and C big N be its complex roots. So f of Ci is equal to 0. And now let me consider the projection that takes the complex space to the sphere. This is Riemann's sphere, really, centered at 0, 0, 1 half, and of total height 1. So you have here the C1, C2, and so on, and then you can consider the stereographic projection, and this C1, C2 give you X1, X2, and so on. So this way we can either transform our problem in the sphere in a problem in the plane, or transform a problem in the plane in a problem in the sphere, as far as we are not just having the North Pole, the South Pole, which is erased from the picture and not meaningful for many reasons. So, well, you consider that problem. And then it happens that, well, the following happens. The condition number of the system at the point theta I is denoted by that, and it's just a quantity that measures how the solution will vary if you vary the polynomial. So it is the same as the condition number in linear algebra that now extended to a nonlinear set. And, well, it is an important quantity because it tells you how accurate your computations have to be and many other things. So, well, one can wonder, so this is the condition number. And let me not write the formula because I don't think that it's really important now. So, well, this is the condition number, whatever. Yes. It's an important quantity for solving, and then one can wonder the following. Choose a polynomial f such that the maximum of the condition number of f at the corresponding roots is minimum. So one can wonder about this problem. And now you may start to see the relation. So you will be very bad conditioned if you have a singular root. You will be pretty bad condition if you have two roots which are very close, which means if you have two roots which are very close, it would mean that your two points in the sphere are very close, which would mean that the Fekete function, the logarithmic potential or logarithmic energy, will be very big. So there starts to appear some relation, and indeed this relation can be specified much more, and it was so the following result, which relates this to quantity, is due to Schumann and Snail. And it says that if W is such that it satisfies Snail's problem, then the maximum of this condition number f of xi, so I will have to be a bit more specific now, but I will just be in words. W satisfying that would mean simply that the points in the Riemann sphere are very well distributed with respect to the logarithmic potential. Then you would consider the pre-immediates in the complex plane, and you would consider the associated polynomial. So, given a set of points in the sphere which are good with respect to the Smith-Semitis problem, this means that the corresponding polynomial has a condition number which is smaller than C, that a constant power of the number of unknowns, which is the number of roots, which is the same as the degree. So, well, this is an apparently not very much to ask, really, a polynomial which is not very bad condition, but it is an extremely difficult problem to say this polynomial satisfies. It's very difficult. Also, Schumann has made proof that any polynomial chosen at random will satisfy with great probability. But it's like those transcendental numbers that you cannot really choose one. also, you know that there exist a lot of them. So, well, let me just say that in words, there is a great chance that a random poly is well conditioned. So this is also due to Schuban. So, well, now one can try to look at the problem in a different way. It is very difficult to compute second point. It is very difficult to compute exactly a polynomial that satisfies that. But a randomly chosen polynomial will satisfy that. So a very reasonable thing to say is you choose a random polynomial, you compute its solutions, you project them into the sphere, and it looks like the thing should work. Yeah, so the distribution is the usual distribution taken in this, which is, so the norm of F, let me just give the scalar product, okay? It suffices to give the scalar product to define a distribution. So the norm, the product of F and G is the integral in the Riemann sphere of F of theta times G of theta bar. In the sphere, no, it is in the circle. In the one-dimensional circle contained in the complexes of these differential fields, times a constant. So it is a somehow sensibly chosen, isn't that? Well, so but this defines a product, and then you have to choose the probability distribution which is uniform with respect to this product or something like that. Well, I can give you a more detailed formula later if I have time, okay? I mean, I have the formula here, so I will give you. So, well, at least I think that the idea is somehow clear that something is happening there, no? So it's difficult to find second points, it's difficult to find good well distribution polynomials, but random polynomials are well distributed, so this should provide a good approximation to second points. And then we recently proved with Diego Armentano, who is here, and with Mike Shub, we proved the following thing.
Sorry, which way does the implication go? You said if the random polynomial satisfies its bound, mm-hmm. but that doesn't imply it satisfies the property.
Right. This doesn't imply, but it makes you think that it might help. So this is just a motivation of why the result that I'm going to write should or make sense to be true. For of course I won't say the proof. So expectation is now with respect to the following. You choose a random polynomial with respect to the Sesdin distribution. You compute its complex roots. You project them onto the sphere. And you compute the expected value of the energy of the associated roots. Okay? So this is too much to write. I will just write that. So the logarithmic energy of the roots of a random polynomial. What is that? So did I erase? Oh, maybe I did. No, I didn't. Oh yes I did. Okay. So this turns to be equal to 1 over 4 log of 4 over e n squared minus 1 over 4 m logarithm of m plus n over 4 log of 4 over e. Now, well, I erased it. But I wanted to compare this to the formula that is known as the minimum. And maybe you don't remember it, but the formula started exactly the same way. It started like that, and then it said it is this plus something which is minus points, blah, 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 times n. So you see, making this process, you already get a pretty precise approximation to the expected value. To the minimum. So we should say that really there is some kind of improvement, some kind of good thing in doing that. And so let me show you some pictures now. Well, this is about computing elliptic second points by this Sanchez. The A didn't appear in LaTeX. So this is a Spanish team which made the following. Essentially, you take a lot of random points in the sphere, and then you let a gradient flow-like algorithm evolve, and then you get kind of a approximation to some local minimum of the elliptic theta function. This is the rate of convergence that they have, and this they can do that for many, many points using a supercomputer and so on. There are a lot of computations. Now, this is just a picture of what I was explaining. You take a random polynomial, you solve it, you project that into the sphere, okay, using that process that I explained, and in order to compare it, you can see it here. I didn't try this 1,000 times until I got the correct thing to show you, I promise. I just did it 10 or 15 times. So these are randomly chosen points. These are points coming from this process of choosing random poly and solving and projecting. And you can see that there is a difference.
What do you mean by random?
Randomly chosen in the sphere with a uniform distribution. So just the distribution that, well, the uniform distribution associated to the usual measure in the sphere. Nothing fancy. No, here I have a random polynomial, then solve it, then project it to the Riemann sphere, and this is what you get. Well, you can see it's pretty different, no? Here you have like many blank spaces, and many of them here, but here you can see you don't have that. Yeah, they are different.
So it looks like your energy gap is that slightly higher than what was written before because it's before you got last term was constant.
Right. Right. Those. So this thing, I would say like it would be better if it was minus 0. Say 2, 2, 3 something m or 1, 1, 4. I don't remember exactly the number. Okay. I mean, it would be better, but it wouldn't be true. So that's but still, so we don't get the approximation to that point, but still, it's an approximation.
If you get an approximation with a constant time n subset, what does that imply about how close your polynomial?
What does that imply about? Oh, yeah. So unfortunately, using this equality and this. No, how is that? Now, can you repeat the question, please?
Yeah, so you've probably got a good polynomial, and that's got a distribution of points. Distribution of points is something within constant times n rather than constant times log n.
Mm-hmm.
So, given a distribution of points with constant times n, go back to the polynomial, which is the one you chose, what can you say about the maximum?
Okay, so what can you say? In the theory, you cannot say much. You will only be able to say that you have some exponentials here. You have c to the m. But I will show that in practice, this does work. So, well, let me just give some disturbing experiments. I think they are disturbing. Maybe there's a lot of people who knows a lot about numerics here, so maybe somebody can explain what I'm going to show now. One would say the following. Now we have seen two ways to choosing points in the sphere. One is the uniform, and one is those coming from random polys. The coming from random polys is clearly much better suited for the Fekete points problem. So well.
So I have another question. So you think from the fact that it comes from a random polynomial.
Yes.
I mean, what if instead I chose one at random, like me, I just chose a polynomial with no particular reason. Would you get something different? I mean,
With no particular reason, you mean with no particular probability distribution?
Well, I just chose one.
So, okay, let me tell you how you have to choose it to accomplish that, okay?
No, but how do you need to choose it not to accomplish that?
Oh, well, for example, this polynomial. This has a lot of... x to the n. Yes, that. This has a super singular root. So the Fekete value is infinity.
So if you were to just take the randomly isoefficient random according to n 0 1, and then you look at the root, you think about the random. So that's what it's worth.
I will write it here. No, I didn't write it. So the definition is the following. You write a polynomial like that, where a sub I is equal to, say, c I plus the imaginary root times di. Okay? So c I and di have to be chosen normal, centered at zero, with variance. Can you see here? No, you can't. So ci plus I di x, or let me call it j x to the j. Then the cj and the dj have to be chosen normal, centered at zero with variance, the combinatorial coefficient n over j to the power of minus. That is somehow a fancy distribution, and it would look a bit unnatural, but it happens to be not unnatural. And the reason why it is not unnatural is because polynomials chosen like that have the property, say that, they have a lot of properties. Among them, that they are invariant, say, under some unitary distribution, unitary transformations on the sphere, and so on. So it's a bit technical. I don't know if I... But I can tell you later if you want. So this is the distribution, anyway. And where it comes from, then I would need some more time to explain. Okay?
The result is only that you get a high probability of getting the picture you want, right?
Right. Yeah, it doesn't prove, of course, as Mathenet's problem, and probably is far from that. But it just gives another piece of information. So well, answer. So we have seen those two ways to choose points in the sphere. Both of them are somehow, they don't have a preference on one side of the sphere or whatever, they are somehow well distributed. One of them is very well suited for segregated points. Someone would say, why, in order to solve the problem that I showed here, why instead of starting at random points, don't you start at those, smartly chosen points? So now I will show you some disturbing experiments. This is what happens when you choose points at random. And these pictures is the following. Well, you choose points at random, you minimize, what you get is this. These are the version, if you take into the complex space, this is what you get. These are just the eigenvalues of the Hessian at the minimum, just to be sure that it's a local minimum. And you can see that all the eigenvalues are positive. Some of them are very, very close to zero, which you expect because there are a lot of symmetries in the picture. And this is the interesting graphic. So this graphic is the following. We have tried this for 10,000. So we have done that 10,000 times. So a certain number of times, what we attained to the minimum that we attained. Okay? And then some other times, we didn't get this minimum, which must mean that there are more local minima, which the method stops there. And this is what happens when you choose points uniformly in the sphere. And exactly the same or a very similar happens if you choose points coming from random polynomials. And I don't understand that. Why should it be? Should be different. They are very different distributions. In particular, they are very different with respect to the objective function that we are looking at. But still, you get this very, very similar probability, you can see, of attaining the minimum value that you attain. And this minimum value is the same in these two cases.
You mean that this gradient flow process does the same thing as either start?
Yeah, I am cheating you a bit because I don't control exactly what the whole minimizing algorithm does, but it's essentially supposed to be a gradient flow algorithm.
You don't see the gradient flow on the Lisp polynomial. Lisp polynomial is the same. Yeah.
You choose a polynomial, you solve it, you take the sphere, and then you do the gradient flow.
It's different inputs.
In those cases, the gradient flow. Right. Just the different way to choose the initial points randomly. So these two functions, these two things are too similar, and this is disturbing. And what is most disturbing is that I say then, okay, let's try with, say, points in the complex sphere coming from random eigenvalues of randomly chosen matrices. Just another weird distribution, another weird way to choose it. And again, the same picture appears. So maybe it's just that the algorithm that I'm using has some kind of preferences or whatever, but it looks like a bizarre thing. And the Spanish team that I mentioned before, they got a similar picture too. So it's not just that the algorithm that I tried, which is simply the naive one in MATLAB, it's not just that this algorithm has something strange, but also the other team got it, the same picture, a very similar one. So it looks like something weird is happening. And Mike should gave a reasonable explanation of this, which maybe you remember, which could be the following. Maybe the local minima are so intricately set in the space that any little error in the computations will make you flip from one point to the other. And if everything is very, very intricated, then flipping to one or the other will only depend on the size of the places where you're going somehow, because there would be a kind of a random distribution. And then maybe this means that for this n equals, I don't remember, maybe 100, then there is such a probability of arriving to the minimum, then there is such other probability of arriving to the other local minimum. Maybe that is happening. Yes, 10,000 trials. Here you have like 1,800 went to the minimal value. Yes, but if you go to n bigger and bigger and bigger, this starts to be smaller and smaller and smaller. So it's not clearly. It's all the time the same n, and it's fixed. Oh, yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah, so I can give you an answer because I couldn't make such an amount of experimentation. This takes like one afternoon in my computer. So. Yeah, yeah, I know. Maybe Carlos would try to. Yeah, I don't know why. I don't know why. Now I seem to remember that the gap goes slower when you go to higher dimensions. I seem to remember that. But maybe just a visual effect of the fact that the numbers are getting bigger. What is? I seem to remember it's 100. So well, just this experiment. And now let me show you another picture which goes in the line of your question before. So it is true that this goes only one direction. If you have a very good minimization thing, then we know that the maximum of the condition number is somehow small. But if you put all these things together, they don't fit well. So if you put together the fact that the minimizing n-tuple with respect to a Smelt problem produces that, the fact that it is very, very probable to find a polynomial which has this equal to n, not n to the 20, n, then this doesn't fit very well. So if you think about that for a while, what must be happening is that this is not sharp. What must be happening is that this should be something like constant times n, maybe. So, well, that is only a bound. It is not an inequality. And, well, I just check that, and I can show you the graphic doing that. So what is done here is the following. You just take, this is n now, so n is growing and growing and growing until it crashes my computer. And what is done here is the following. You fix n, say 87, then you do some heuristic process to compute a minimizing Fekete point, which we are not rigorous here, just a local minimum, but whatever. And then we compute this condition number, and we check what it happens. And instead of n to the power of c, it goes growing like that. So minimizing, really minimizing thing should go like log n, log log n, and not n to the c, which is what's the problem. So now I'm wondering Yeah, I said here CN, and there is some log n there, but it's because I changed my scale at some point, so I'm sorry about that. Oh, yeah, so the thing is that here we are computing log of the energy, which is comparable to the log of the condition number. And here I'm not showing log of the condition number, but the condition number itself. It is, so that is the thing that is there. Well, just, so don't pay much attention to that. And I'm done.
Just a curiosity. In that case, when you have the best, say, condition number for low degrees, say degree 3, 4, 5, is the polynomial known? Because it should be known.
For degree 2, it is. For degree 3 or 4, I'm not sure.
Degree 3 or 4 or 5, or even up to 10, maybe, should be feasible. And see what happens with this curious polynomial, which is the best condition.
Yeah, well, you know what happens? Really, there is not one polynomial. There are many of them because there is a lot of symmetry in the pictures.
No. So,
and then what I didn't really try with these very small values, but I tried with some not so small values. And what happens is just the numbers mean nothing. Like maybe the coefficient of x is 1 point, blah, 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 the coefficient is, blah, 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 but I couldn't see any relation. You know.
You have to find out the minimum, or you can pose the problem with x.
Right.
Including a case s equals 0 as a limit with the logarithmic potential as usual. Okay. Then, assume that you have a minimum, some minimizer, no? Which is assumed the optimal global minimizer for some value of s. If then you change the value of s, you expect that if the change is very small, you still have a minimum.
Yes.
But is something known about the bifurcations in the minima when you change the S? Because in many cases, changing the potential, say, is quite useful in other kinds of problems.
So according to what I read, and I read quite a lot for that, there is nothing known, really, about that. There are some bounds which are understood. For example, one knows that if you are in a minimizing tuple for the logarithmic potential, then this thing function, the maximum of the distances, is bounded by something. So some relations are not like that. But essentially, nothing really, really sharp.
Then a final question is that, well, you're looking for minima, but there are a lot of minima. Take n equal to 1,000, there are many minima and many other critical points.
Yes.
Is it possible to have some idea about how many critical points should appear in the problem?
There is a conjecture that this number is exponential, but this is not known. And the conjecture is due to, well, maybe I can tell you. I wrote too many things. I don't know if I can find it now. But I can tell you later. But there is a conjecture, and it is not really known. According to the experimentation, I would say that there are a lot of them. A lot of them. But nothing known. Yeah, right. So you think that this proves that there are a lot of... But you have all this symmetry playing around and so on, and you're minimizing in the sphere, power to n. So when... Yes, I remember that you used that argument in the Basut 3 article. But I wasn't sure if this was a proof or a clue that this should be happening. Maybe you can...
That's
because in 1993 you wrote...
Okay, well, you can answer tomorrow. Any other questions?
Yes. In what cases do you present it to work? So taking points on random sphere and points coming from a polynomial in both cases, can we measure the volume of the part of the sphere in counting the points?
Yes.
So is it this property which makes the picture so single?
So I tried also with the eigenvalue, random eigenvalue, which does not have that property, and it produces the same picture. And those Spanish team, they also tried with some points which were chosen randomly only in a small cap of the sphere. And at the end they produced the same picture. And if the points are in a small cap of the sphere, obviously there is no such a property.
Mm-hmm. Is there a lot of local minima?
Yeah, so that's what I was answering. There must be a lot.
For any 1,000 would be billions of minima.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, for the global minimum for endpoints, do you notice that the sphere likes some values at end? I mean, besides, you know, like large, you know, like if it prefers, say, 101 over 102, are there certain numbers for which the energy is especially low?
Especially low for particular numbers?
Yeah.
I doubt that.
Okay,
no, because there is, yeah, this bound is known, which grows like n square.
I mean, especially, I mean, some.
Yeah, yeah, so.
Special.
I don't know. Yeah, in general, no. Nothing.
I think if I remember, I used to experiments on mu, which I didn't do myself. This was around more than 20 years ago. We had Matt Grayson. And he took something like nice solid inside, and then he started dividing the faces and projecting the sphere. He would get nice results up until around 120 something. And somewhere after 120 something, it'd be a break. Every now and then, with the strategy, and we found out definite dimension where they were okay. And what those dimensions are, we don't have any more.
And I forgot to explain what those pictures are at the end. So let me just show you. This is the process of minimizing the energy for the Coulomb potential, case S equal 1. And there's a program that does that, and that is what it produces. As I say, this is random. And this is a construction by Saf and Kuglars that they make a particular construction starting at the bottom of the sphere, then they go a bit up and a bit right, a bit up, a bit right, a bit up, a bit right, and they compute the number of up, the amount of up and the amount of right that you have to choose to have good properties. And so, well, this is the solution. And you can see there is some kind of a spiral here. So these are spiral points. Yeah, right. They use that to prove the upper or the lower bound, one of their two bounds on the limb sup and limb in. No, I haven't tried.
Okay, let us thank the speaker again.